Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on Air. On this week's show, we'll learn about active surveillance of prostate cancer.
With active surveillance, we're actually following you very closely. And what we're looking at is we're looking for any signs of progression of the prostate cancer. Because if we've seen there's any signs of progression, then we treat.
Plus, what is special about rehabilitation services?
We're talking about today in terms of rehabilitation. Deals with these people with very significant changes in their life based on injury or medical conditions, and a comprehensive approach to getting them not only medically sound, but also physically and emotionally reintegrated back into their home communities.
And the potential health risks of that controversial process called fracking. All that and a selection from our Healing Muse, and that's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On this week's show, we learn how rehabilitation can help move patients from injury to health. Plus, we examine the potential health risks of fracking. But first, an update on prostate cancer treatments. Well, the American Cancer Society estimates that this year in the United States there will be about 220,000 new cases of prostate cancer, with almost 28,000 deaths from this disease. And since one man in seven will be diagnosed with prostate cancer at some time in his life, how does one determine the best approach to treatment? Well, here with more on all of this is Dr. Rakesh Khanna. He's Assistant Professor of Urology at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Khanna. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
So, you know, there's been a lot of controversy in recent years about the best way to treat prostate cancer, but let's begin for our listeners with a brief overview before we get to treatment. First, what exactly is prostate cancer?
So, prostate cancer is basically a disorderly growth of the glands in the prostate. The prostate is basically an organ that secretes ejaculate fluid that's responsible for when men ejaculate during sexual intercourse. When these glands, they become disorganized in their growth, that is what we call prostate cancer, when they're no longer normal-appearing glands.
Now, people have problems with their prostate as well, and it's not cancer. That's often termed something benign prostatic hyperplasia, and that can interfere with things like urination and all kinds of bodily function. But that is not cancer. There's a distinction between that.
Absolutely. So benign prostatic hyperplasia, or BPH, simply refers to having an enlarged prostate gland. It does not mean cancer of the prostate gland.
So do we know what causes prostate cancer?
There are probably multiple genetic abnormalities that lead to prostate cancer, which is the abnormality that causes the cancer, that we don't know. But there's intense research developed in this.
They're researching it very carefully and trying to understand what are the changes in the DNA of the cell that leads the growth to kind of become out of control.
Yes.
And the danger of that, though, is when it's limited to the prostate gland itself, it's contained. But isn't the danger basically when it metastasizes outside?
Exactly. And again, that's where a lot of the research is going right now, because we're trying to identify on the molecular level, at the DNA level, can we see which gene abnormalities are responsible from taking it to a confined stage to a metastatic stage where it's spread outside the prostate, because the outcomes are very different.
So what are the risk factors? What would lead someone, it sounds like quite a lot of men, one in seven, do face prostate cancer at some time in their lives. What are the risk factors contributing to this?
So the number one risk factor is age. That means if you're a man and you live long enough, you're going to get a prostate cancer. Now, the thing to keep in mind is that many men are going to have very small prostate cancers. They're never going to know about it in their lifetime.
Because basically, are they often asymptomatic?
They're asymptomatic. And, you know, only a small percentage of those men are going to be symptomatic. And even a smaller percentage of those men are actually going to die from prostate cancer. So again, it's as you get older, it's just very, it's just a fact of life, actually, as you get older. Aside from age, probably race, African Americans do have a higher incidence.
And we don't know why,
We don't know why. Mm-hmm. And family history, yeah. Early family history of prostate, not just any family history, right? But again, early age onset family history is probably associated with prostate cancer.
How about diet? Is there been any links to the kind of diet? Like Western diet has certainly been found to be responsible for many, many disease entities.
So not 100% associated.
And how about obesity?
Again, not 100% associated, but again, there is some data that people who are obese, they do tend to do worse with regards to prostate cancer.
So in other words, if they get prostate cancer, the outcome is more serious.
Exactly.
How about things like smoking? Because that obviously plays a role in many, many, many other disease entities.
So I'm not advocating smoking. Smoking is not good for you. There's 100 reasons to stop smoking. Has smoking conclusively been established with prostate cancer? No.
Well, how about things like workplace exposures, any of those kinds of things, or sexually transmitted diseases? Do those play a role?
Again, not 100% established, right? So there are some chemical exposures, veterans, for example, who have been exposed in the war to chemicals, right? But just a typical workplace exposure, no.
So are there things that people can do to prevent? In other words, if these risk factors that you mentioned, it almost sounds like if you live long enough, you will get it. But the more concerning prostate cancer is when you get it early and you're younger. Mm-hmm. So are there things that they found that might play a role in terms of prevention? Are there lifestyle things?
Again, not conclusively. There are some data, depending on the type of foods you eat, physical activity, can decrease the rate of the prostate cancer. But again, conclusively, no. Now, having said that, again, it's just good sense to be active, be healthy, eat proper. That's good. Is that going to decrease your risk of prostate cancer? Again, not conclusively. It definitely will not increase your risk of prostate cancer.
How do you know, for example, I guess we started talking about prostate cancer and about the fact that very often it's asymptomatic. So how does one know they have prostate cancer or that either, lead to some suspicion they may have it?
That's a great question. We've actually gone through two stages in prostate cancer treatment. Back in the 1980s and before, we were diagnosing primarily people with prostate cancer based on physical examination, meaning we felt a big nodule on the prostate. At that stage, a lot of people came with advanced disease, meaning they came with their kidneys blocked, they came with blood in their urine or difficulty urinating, they came with kidney failure, they came with the prostate cancer having spread to their bones, and they get a lot of bone pain.
So by then, it was really hard to treat.
It was, exactly. Now, since the 90s and up until more recently, we've actually been diagnosing most of the prostate cancers through PSA screening.
And that's basically as a result of a blood test.
Exactly.
And you're looking for something in the blood that indicates what? Inflammation? What does it tell you?
So, great question. So, PSA is a blood, it's an enzyme from the prostate. It stands for prostate-specific antigen. It's not prostate cancer-specific antigen, it's prostate-specific antigen. What we find is that with patients who have prostate cancer, the PSA level is elevated. Now, PSA is not the perfect test, by no means. You can have prostate cancer with a PSA, with a normal PSA, and depending on what your PSA is, you might not have prostate cancer, okay? But PSA is the best screening test we have right now. Now, people are doing additional research or trying to find other modalities to help diagnose prostate cancer, but right now, PSA is what we're using, and by no means perfect. The whole point, though, is getting back to your question earlier, nowadays, because we're screening, we're trying to find the prostate cancers before they become symptomatic, because we're trying to find them with the idea that they're localized. And if they're localized and they're smaller and we treat them, you will have a better outcome.
So getting back to that whole idea, what you're saying is routinely these days, if you go for an adult exam, a physical exam with your your general internist or your family practitioner or what have you, your primary care provider, you would have a screening test like a PSA in most cases?
Great question. A lot of controversy about that. The U.S. Preventative Services Task Force actually came out with a recommendation advising against PSA screening. Because, again, PSA is not the perfect test. It can lead to a lot of false positive diagnoses, and it can lead to a lot of over-treatments. So you have to be careful when you order the test, okay?
But
now,
but
I will tell you, though, we do have data. There was a large study done in Europe where they screened men with PSA, and it found it did decrease the mortality from prostate cancer in men who got screened. The caveat to that, though, was that we had to treat a lot of men in order to save a lot of men.
And there may have been unnecessary treatment
exactly,
along the way.
Exactly. So we can diagnose the cancers, but we have to also work better on how do we treat them afterwards.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, along with urologist Dr. Rakesh Khanna, and we're talking about prostate cancer. So therein lies the rub. I mean, that's where the controversy has been. Our diagnostic methodology is somewhat limited. It's better than it was because at least now you do have a non-invasive blood test to begin the process. And then you basically are left with this kind of dilemma. Who do you screen? What does the test tell you? And it's my understanding, and help us understand this better, that part of the problem is it's really difficult to determine how aggressive a particular type of cancer in the prostate may be, and it varies. Some people have very quiet, non-aggressive tumor, and others have extremely aggressive, which are the ones you want to get. And the PSA, am I correct, doesn't really tell
it,
you
it
that.
It does not. So the PSA, the key point when you talk to me, the PSA does not diagnose prostate cancer. The only way you diagnose the prostate cancer and to get to how do you identify the aggressiveness of the prostate cancer is to do a biopsy of the prostate. So that is the diagnostic test. So then depending what the PSA level is, depending what the biopsy results show, depending on what your physical exam findings are, then we categorize as to which type of prostate cancer it is. Do we think this is probably a low grade or not a dangerous prostate cancer, or is this a very dangerous prostate cancer?
And obviously, if it's very dangerous, you want to get in there and do the most aggressive treatment possible, including surgery, perhaps radiation, all kinds of things. What's come up in recent years, though, is this whole notion, as you said, with the U.S. Preventative Task Force saying don't even screen. And I know there are some countries that do not even screen for prostate, for PSA. Is this whole notion of two things. One is called watchful waiting, and another is called active surveillance. First of all, what's the difference between those two, and what are they?
So both watchful waiting and active surveillance refer to after being diagnosed with prostate cancer. What both of them rely upon is that there are many cancers, they're not going to cause any real symptoms or effect on your lifetime. So the idea, for example, for watchful waiting is we say, look, it's not going to bother you, leave it. Unless it causes you a problem at some point in your life, then we'll deal with it. With active surveillance, we're actually following you very closely. That means with repeat blood tests, repeat physical exam, with a repeat prostate biopsy, and what we're looking at is we're looking for any signs of progression of the prostate cancer, whether it's grown in size, whether under the microscope it's become a little bit more aggressive, whether on exam it's grown. Because if we've seen there's any signs of progression, then we treat. So one is basically treatment before spreads, before it becomes symptomatic, with the intent of cure. The watchful waiting is more of a symptomatic treatment.
But isn't there a potential downside to both of those in that you lose time and allow the cancer to perhaps grow and spread and cause more havoc?
100% you're correct. And that's where, again, you have to appropriately select which patients should go on either approach.
How do you do that?
With the three things we look at. Again, the PSA, which is the blood test, because if it's a low PSA, your biopsy shows a low-grade prostate cancer, and there's not a lot on the biopsy, probably this is not something that's going to be an issue. Probably will be safe to watch it.
And will the patient's age play a role here? So are we talking, for example, if you're somebody who's got only likely 20 years of life ahead of you or 15 years of life ahead of you, the chances are you might choose something less aggressive.
So exactly. So the age does play a role. The other issue is actually what's important to the patient. So patients might find certain quality of life values very important to them. That with treatments, these are such significant side effects.
So, for example,
one of the risks of surgery, one of the risks of radiation therapy is erectile dysfunction or urinary leakage. And a patient might say, look, I'm young. These are things I don't want to lose. I don't want to risk it. And that's reasonable. And then depending on the type of the cancer they have, surveillance might be a very reasonable option for them.
So do you find that, how about in terms of the long, if someone is probably in the middle of their life and they have a lot of life ahead of them potentially, and they're looking at a low-grade type of cancer, would you then advocate for something to that patient? And of course, they don't want to take the chance.
So I advocate to every patient when I see them in the clinic. There's always the same options for prostate cancer. There's surveillance, there's surgery, there's radiation therapy, and there's cryosurgery. There's always the same options. But absolutely, for somebody who's a little bit older, who has a lower grade disease, I strongly recommend active surveillance.
And I guess the question is, in your experience, does that ever lead to, you know, negative consequences where you've lost time and the person ends up getting a very, profound spread?
Touch wood, no.
Touch wood, no. So generally, this whole notion of active surveillance does save on the idea of surgery for many people.
Surgery and radiation treatment for the
prostate.
More
aggressive treatment.
Yes.
And people can basically live with prostate cancer is what you're saying.
And they never know about it. Because again, we found it through a blood test that they would never have known otherwise.
Well, that's very helpful information. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing it with us. It has been a quandary for a lot of people, but I think you've put a fine point on it. Thanks again for coming in. My guest has been Dr. Rakesh Khanna, Assistant Professor of Urology at Upstate Medical University. Coming up next, how rehabilitation services help bring patients from injury to health. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen along with you. Well, after an injury or some serious disease process, patients need to gather up their resources to return to their way of life before the event. Here to tell us more about the critical process of rehabilitation are Dr. Robert Weber, professor and chair of the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation and the director of Physical Medicine and the Rehabilitation Outpatient Clinic, and Dr. Margaret Turk, professor of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, both from Upstate Medical University. Thank you so much for coming in. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Turk, let me begin with you. When we start talking about this process, what do we mean when we say rehabilitation? What does that actually mean?
Right. That's a very difficult thing because people have their own sense of what rehabilitation is. So we talk about drug rehabilitation and conservation rehabilitation and building rehabilitation. What we're really talking about is returning to as much as a higher level of function. It's more of a restoration. Actually, back when they were trying to call this something, there were a number of terms that people used, and restoration was one of them, but rehabilitation actually came to the forefront. So in the medical setting, and again, this was brought up, this rehabilitation, physical medicine and rehabilitation, came up through a typical medical system. So it does have some medical flavor to it. It is comprehensive. It is a group of people. It's a team, so it's not just the physician, but it is a number of disciplines, a variety of therapies who work together in conjunction with the patient and the family to define some realistic goals to be able to try to attain to increase your level of function, either to returning to your previous level or to a level of independence in which you can return to home or you can return to home with some kind of support.
So Dr. Turk explained that this kind of grew up and evolved in this country. What was the impetus? What was the history behind this whole notion of rehabilitation medicine?
Well, like so many things technologically in the country, war was a big part of it. And so the advances in medicine that took place during the Second World War created a large number of people with severe injuries who survived the battlefield and came back to the United States looking and needing to be reintegrated into our society. And so rehabilitation became an important part of the medical system within the military and the Veterans Administration, where it really began. And in what we're talking about today in terms of rehabilitation, comprehensive rehabilitation, deals with these people with very significant changes in their life based on injury or medical conditions, and a comprehensive approach to getting them not only medically sound, but also physically and emotionally reintegrated back into their home communities.
So give me an idea, Dr. Weber, give me an idea of who we're talking about. I mean, obviously, we've just come off some very serious, new, more recent wars. We have all of these veterans coming back from Iraq or Afghanistan. Who are the kinds of patients that are seen within this world of rehabilitation medicine today?
Well, from both the military and the civilian standpoint, some form of brain injury or neurologic injury is the biggest group of people. And so traumatic brain injury or post-traumatic stress disorders, which you see with people who have been in combat, are probably the biggest group. So stroke individuals who have had paralysis.
So other than within the military, you're right. Saying non-war related injury.
Non-war related. In the civilian population, you're talking about trauma, multiple trauma from mostly motor vehicle accidents, or around here, sports and outdoor injuries from boating or cross-country skiing and all the other kinds of activities we have here. But also stroke is very important, spinal cord injury, a number of the ongoing problems like multiple sclerosis.
I was going to say, there are disease entities also right. That would lend themselves to this.
Right. And then some of the kind of complex orthopedic problems, back injuries and so forth, which are complicated. And a number of disease processes, cardiac issues and cancer. Cancer rehab is a very important part of making these people very capable of returning back to home and their activities. So we're looking at people with significant changes based on medical or traumatic problems and getting them optimized both medically and emotionally and functionally back into the community.
I think we also have to recognize that it crosses ages. So it's not just the middle-aged population. We're talking about children who also sustain significant injuries, who can have stroke, who can have cancer, and rehabilitation is very helpful to them, as well as our geriatric population who have similar things as well. Now, the two ends of the spectrum may have things that are a little more specific to that age group, but nonetheless, there is the general theme that anyone, any age, can benefit, for the most part, from rehabilitation.
So what exactly, why is a formal rehabilitation process necessary? What are the benefits, either of you, what are the benefits of that, as opposed to, I don't know, something less?
Well, the challenges that these individuals and their family face are very complex, and they cover a very large area of personal function and social interaction. And so the comprehensive approach deals not only with stabilizing and optimizing their medical condition, which is an important part of what we do in the hospital setting where we operate, but also in optimizing their mobility, their ability to care for themselves, to take care of their own personal care needs, their medications, their psychological well-being. The understanding of the family and the employer and the community in terms of their particular needs and how to best help them come back into a full functioning relationship with the community.
Either through accommodation in some cases or various methodologies to help them adjust or adapt.
It is all of those. The first focus is on obviously optimizing the individual's ability and their family's understanding and assistance in this process. But then secondly, it is looking at how can we change their environment? How can we help employers or their educational institutions or whatever better help them return to the functions that are needed? We're very fortunate in the United States in that over the last 30 years or so, the legal system has created the expectation that the community will make some accommodations.
The American Disabilities Act
Americans
and all
with
that.
Disabilities mm-hmm. Act. Mm-hmm. And part of our role is helping people understand what they can expect back in the community.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, along with rehabilitation specialists Dr. Robert Weber and Dr. Margaret Turk. We're talking about rehabilitation and the wide range of services that can be offered. Getting back to that, Dr. Turk, you initially started to talk to us about the team approach and how important all of the players are in this team. Let's just give us an overview of who they are and what they do.
Right. In the formal process of rehabilitation, this means that there is a team. It's not individual therapies, but it is a team. It's coordinated. As I mentioned, we have goals that we try to address. And so the entire team, which includes the patient and the family, define what these are. So a part of the team would be the physician or physiatrist, doctor of physical medicine or rehabilitation. On the inpatient unit, rehabilitation nursing is really very important. Now, let me back up and say there is credentialing and special education for all of these areas, both broadly in terms of rehabilitation, but also in some specific patient condition areas. So again, on the unit, or the living unit, as we would call it, an inpatient, the physician and the rehabilitation nurses are most important. Other therapists that engage in the process, who also work with the patient on the unit as well as in the gym, are physical therapy, very well known, occupational therapy, less well understood, speech pathology. And then there are a variety of other support systems that are in place. So the psychologists and neuropsychologists, recreation specialists, therapeutic recreation specialists, social workers, case managers, pastoral care. There are a variety of people who should be available and on the unit for an inpatient comprehensive program. We also bring other people into the team process as well. So if someone needs a brace, an orthotist will be engaged, or a prosthetist for someone with an amputation, a limb loss, to develop a prosthesis. For pediatrics, we use Child Life. Something that's very important. Audiologists can be helpful if we have hearing problems, and vision specialists as well, because there can be loss of these sensory problems, as sensory skills, as well as loss of physical skills.
So where, for the most part, you keep alluding to the inpatient setting. Clearly, you offer something that's unique in the sense that you have a fairly comprehensive program to offer when someone is an inpatient in the hospital, Dr. Weber. So is that the main kind of focus for rehabilitation medicine, or are there other circumstances as well?
Well, that is the focus for individuals with very significant impairments or medical issues. And one of the key elements that the hospital-based inpatient program offers these people is not only do we have the comprehensive rehabilitation team and a physician management of their program, but we have access to all of the other physician specialties that have worked with them. So for instance, the neurosurgeon or the trauma orthopedic surgeon that has been engaged in their case from the very beginning continues to help manage the problems that these individuals have. And so it's a comprehensive medical approach. But in terms of the kinds of things that we can offer, there is also the more focused restoration type services that we can provide, not only to individuals, let's say, focused sports injuries out in the community, where we provide those services at the Institute for Human Performance or in Manlius at our center, or
so as an outpatient,
outpatient program. But we also provide these follow-on services for individuals who have been in the comprehensive rehabilitation program and who are now back in the community but need further services. There are also home services that can be delivered, particularly in the transition to home. And some individuals, because they need a less intense or are able to benefit from a less intense program, may be served in a skilled nursing facility. But those programs are constrained in terms of the amount of services that they offer and the amount of medical support and supervision they can give. So there's sort of a tier, multiple tier system of how rehabilitation services are delivered. And some people actually start at the very intense level in the inpatient setting and then move through these different levels to get back to home.
In your own experience, either of you, both of you, how have you seen these rehabilitation services impact the outcome or the quality of life for your patients, either of you?
I think what is best is that both patient and family learn how to live within the now limitation that they may have, because rehabilitation is not curative. It is care. And I think that's important to recognize. Some people will completely improve. Most people always have some limitation.
So it's kind of adjusting to the new normal, to speak.
Exactly. And it is both the patient and the family that makes a difference. So they can go back to school when they leave, or they can go back to work. Maybe it's modified, maybe it isn't. They can go back to homemaking activities. They can take on their social role that they had before if they are able. And that is so important for people to feel good about themselves. And that's kind of what it's all about.
Yeah, absolutely. And in your experience, you've seen that kind of success.
Very much so. I think when we're growing up, we have many years to adjust to our skills and our capabilities. Someone with a sudden change because of illness or injury has to go through that process in a very truncated way. And what comprehensive rehabilitation offers is the support to make that a success.
Well, that's really very hopeful information, and I want to thank you both for coming in and sharing your experience and your wisdom and all of this important information. My guests have been Dr. Robert Weber, professor and chair of the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation and the director of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation Outpatient Clinic, and Dr. Margaret Turk, professor of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation as well, both from Upstate Medical University. Next up, the controversy around fracking rages on, but are there also health risks to be considered? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air, Linda Cohen along with you. Well, as the United States continues to meet its energy needs using domestic sources, the controversy over fracking continues, with scientists and activists on both sides engaged in the battle for public opinion. Joining me to elucidate his position on this controversial methodology and its impact on our health and the health of our environment is Dr. Donald Siegel. He's the Jesse Page Heroy Professor and Department Chair and the Laura J. and L. Douglas Meredith Professor in the Department of Earth Sciences at Syracuse University. Welcome. So thank you so much for coming in, Dr. Siegel.
It's my pleasure.
So let's begin by explaining to our listeners, what exactly is fracking?
Okay, fracking is a fairly novel way of extracting oil or gas, natural gas, from rocks that otherwise you can't get oil and gas out of. Typically in the past, when we found oil or gas supplies, geologists would drill a vertical pipe deep in the ground, and the oil and gas would often just naturally flow out of the rock because there was so much porosity, holes in the rock, such that the it's called a reservoir, much like a drinking water reservoir. It's the same thing, except in this case, the rock would be filled with oil or gas. But that kind of supply is pretty much gone around the world. So we're having diminishing oil and gas supplies. This engineer in Oklahoma figured out a way to take the oil and gas locked in the grains of the rock, to be able to get that out using this process called hydraulic fracking. And in a nutshell, what's done is you can take the vertical pipe and you can turn it horizontally a mile or two deep in the ground using gyroscopes, and then extend it horizontally in your rock that contains this finely disseminated oil and gas that is locked in the rock grains. And then you inject water under high pressure, and it creates cracks in the rock that allow the oil and gas to flow out of the rock into the cracks, then into the pipe, then out of the pipe, and then into the refinery, so to speak. What makes it controversial to some people, many people actually, is that along with the water, there are other substances that are injected in order to keep the hole open, if you will. For example, antibactericides are put in there to prevent bacteria deep in the ground from colonizing in the holes in the pipe, preventing the oil and gas from coming in. There are chemicals called anti-corrosion agents that are used, for example, under your car to prevent corrosion in the wintertime from salt. The same kinds of compounds are then put in the ground along with the water in order to prevent the same thing from happening, you know, to the pipe.
So in addition to basically doing something unnatural in terms of extracting this oil and gas, we are also putting into our environment some things that have never been there before or don't belong there. We're upsetting the natural balance.
We're putting into the environment things that never were there before. We've done this on many, many circumstances, from using pesticides to fertilizers and so forth. But what concerns people is when you pump the oil and gas comes out of the ground using this method, also some of these fluids come back out. And so there's issues of disposal. There's issues of if the well isn't constructed properly, can these fluids leak out from the outside of the pipe into shallow aquifers, you know, thousands of feet above where the production zone is?
And then aquifers meaning basic
water wells, right? Yes. Most of the issues have to do with domestic water wells that might be contaminated by what we call this flowback water, the water that flows back with the oil and gas.
So, just as far as the effect or the overall effect of this fracking, it has changed dramatically the United States' position in terms of energy in the world, hasn't it?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I tell my students this when I give talks on energy issues for the future. Prior to this new method of drilling, we had reached what was commonly known as peak oil. This was predicted decades ago, where the resource of easily extractable oil and gas was being depleted and would ostensibly pretty much disappear in a number of decades. What this has done is completely reset the time clock. The United States, I understand, is the biggest producer of oil and gas in the world now.
Only in a few years.
And only in a few years.
Made a major
Absolutely.
Transition.
It's been an incredible game changer. And the reality is there's so much of this, what we call shale gas and shale oil globally, that there's an almost indefinite, we could be using this for the foreseeable future if we choose to do it.
And that's something that we obviously want to talk a little
bit more
about.
That's right.
So help us understand a little bit more about it. In New York State alone, there's a specific area that the Marcellus Shale formation. Tell us a little bit about that one.
Yes, the Marcellus Shale is the shale that's gotten all the attention. It's a black shale. You can see it in Marcellus, New York. If you drive from here to Skaneateles and go through Marcellus, as you pass through the town, you'll see, on the way to Skaneateles, you'll see these black outcrops of rock. And that's the Marcellus Rock. It's right at the land surface there and then tips into the ground to be miles deep to the south.
And it runs all the way down
Virginia. West Virginia, Pennsylvania. And this is uniquely rich with organic matter. And so the Marcellus right now is the largest producer of of gas in what we call the Appalachian Basin, in the Appalachian region. Underneath it is another shale called the Utica Shale that people can see if they get off the highway freeway at Utica, big, thick, black rock.
And is this true throughout the country that there are these basically large amounts of shale formations throughout the United States?
Pretty much all over not everywhere in the country, but in large chunks of the country, there are what are known as sedimentary basins underlying Michigan, near Denver, Colorado, of course, Texas, Louisiana, down into Mississippi. There's a lot of this kind of rock.
So the supply, it seems to me, based on everything you've told us so far, is large, is great.
That's correct.
And as you're saying, it's almost in the unforeseeable future, we would not run out of gas and oil.
It seems that way. There are some people who argue that some of the estimates are inappropriately large. But right now, there's so much gas that it's hardly being drilled anymore. It's just simply the price has dropped so much.
But does it, yeah. I mean, besides the whole environmental, well, I want to talk more about what the environmental concerns are and health concerns, clearly. Mm-hmm. But this notion that it will go on forever, I mean, we thought that probably, 50 years ago that there was no end to the amount of oil in Texas, for example, or places in the United States that were easily accessible. So is it a little short-sighted to think that this newfound supply will last? I mean, is that a positive environmental approach or energy approach?
Well, to begin with, I don't encourage the United States to continue to use oil and gas for its energy resource. The biggest challenge, and this is where people confuse my position on hydraulic fracking. We'll talk later, I suspect, on what I've discovered in my research and my understanding of the actual real health effects that might come out of it based on water and perhaps air. But I share those concerns with the environmental community that we need to get off of fossil fuels because the climate is in fact changing because of our burning of fossil fuels. Even the former President Bush admits this is happening. Even ExxonMobil admits it's happening. And we need to get to alternative energy resources.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, along with earth scientist and geologist Dr. Donald Siegel. And we're talking about fracking and its impact on our health. I don't want to run out of time. Tell me, what are the concerns for health? Water is one. Tell us about that. And then you mentioned air as well.
Sure. The water that comes back with the, when you produce this kind of oil and gas, there's a chance that some of the wells will leak out gas, and the gas will then enter local drinking water supplies and then degas into the airspace of houses.
And what will that do to our health?
Well, that can cause the house to explode.
Okay.
So it's much like if you leave your stove on. All right, and then you light a match.
So there's safety issues there, but
that's
how about the health of drinking water?
Now, the health of the drinking water, I've not seen any real evidence to suggest that there's any broad problem. There's a lot of salt that comes out with the water. So obviously, if that gets in a water supply, you can contaminate it with salt, much like road salt would contaminate our drinking water supplies. But in my research, in my review of the literature, I've seen no examples of drinking water being contaminated by fracking fluids, unless there's a surface spill, which occasionally will happen, and then it percolates down.
How about air? You had some concern about air quality, apart from the idea of burning fossil fuel and affecting our air quality, but specifically the fracking. What does it do to our air?
Well, the fracking, it's an industrial process, and much like when I-81 is going to be redone. If people are near where the construction is, you will actually smell diesel fuel in the air. You will smell organic compounds in the air. And that same kind of air quality degradation occurs at a drilling site. And so obviously those who work on drilling sites may suffer if they don't take proper precautions, potential air quality issues associated with this organic substances coming off of the actual process.
So it could be a workplace environmental
exposure. It's a workplace environmental exposure. I've, again, not seen any credible evidence that would suggest that you would find this ubiquitously in an area where you'd have a rig every a mile or two apart. That's there. That's quite distant. And
so the main controversy, and you've been somewhat of a firebrand or a lightning rod.
Lightning
rod for a lot of this. But I'm getting the feeling that it's mostly that you have not found supporting evidence, scientific evidence, to suggest that our water, for example, will be compromised, as many have said. But you also do support this notion of getting off of fossil fuel.
Absolutely. You know, the whole irony is that I agree with almost all the concerns that the opposition to fracking has in upstate New York. I agree we need to get off of fossil fuels. But having said that, people have to give as well on the environmental side. We have to accept very large solar arrays, for example, in places that might be unsightly, or large wind farms, or dare I say, think about nuclear as an option. But we there's no free ride here, and there's always some sort of consequence to somebody in terms of quality of life. But I do agree that when the oil and gas industry comes in, you will have more trucks, you'll have rigs out there that will be temporary, not very long. They won't be as persistent. And that will be disruptive. There will be larger communities. There could be boom and bust in some places, depending.
That has happened throughout the United States.
Yeah, it has right now as the prices have dropped, you know, North Dakota being a great example. And these are all social issues, and I really agree with them, that these have to be carefully looked at. What I don't agree with them is that you make up things about water quality issues and get the public fearful about that because it's a good hook to capture the public's attention. That's using any means to achieve an end. And once you use science inappropriately to achieve the wrong ends,
it's
a slippery slope. It's a real slippery slope. So while I'm a lightning rod and that I've published and continue to publish papers showing that there's no generic harm, you know, a large-scale harm just with respect to fracking, respect to water. At the same time, you know, I support, that's the science, all right? But I do support going to alternatives as fast as possible.
Well, I thank you so much for coming in. It's a very, very important subject, something I think people, especially in our region, are so concerned about, especially because of our ample supply of the Marcellus Shale and all of that. But I do think you've really clarified it very, very well and taught us a whole lot.
Okay.
Thanks so much for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
My guest has been Dr. Donald Siegel. He's the Jesse Page Heroy Professor and Department Chair and the Laura J. and L. Douglas Meredith Professor in the Department of Earth Sciences at Syracuse University. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. I'm going to read a poem by Kathleen Grieger, a poet from Wisconsin, who suffered a traumatic brain injury and as a result has been afflicted with seizures and the inability sometimes to say the words she wishes to say. She's very frustrated. She's gone to become her own patient advocate, which is something we urge each other to do. And she's created a very clever poem in which she weaves together her thoughts along with the quotes she's received from various physicians who are not at all, to her mind anyway, sympathetic. Her poem is called Waiting for Answers. I am told time may make seizures recede. Having many problems without any answers, I decide to gain back my control. I start my research, believing ideas, possibilities, and answers are simply waiting to be found. Finding a company that develops the surgical equipment, I contact them. They have a meeting. I'm given names considered the best. I am thankful. I correspond with the surgeons suggested. I wait for replies. I find myself checking my emails daily, then repeatedly, confident someone will be inclined to help. I am surprised with the response. They seem to be uncomfortable, as though helping is the wrong thing to do. I get replies that are polite. I do not work in that field. I cannot answer those questions, as I do not work with you. Some fill me quite simply with fear. There is no reason to think I can help you. You should not hold out hope for a final answer to all your problems. Checking again, I see there are many things wrong. You have a difficult and frustrating dilemma. Unfortunately, this is not news to me. I am told then my life contains a multiplicity of problems, and while you may be helped in the future, you should never be expecting your life to return as it was at all. I get hope from one neurosurgeon. He writes, "Your information will go to the neurologist I work with. I am so looking forward to meeting with you." I send him a note making sure he understands I did say my insurance would not cover me out of state. I do not hear from him again. I read about one who has not answered me. He is giving a lecture in Washington, the effects of seizures on speech, something I have been trying to find out. One tells me, there are some things you should not base your dreams upon, as they will never happen. I refuse to believe this is true. They seem neither able nor willing to share secrets of knowledge. I sit at night and wonder if I ever will silence my seizures. I feel as though I was dropped, a crystal allowed to shatter. No one is ready to pick up the shards, reassemble my life as it was before. Going back to my computer, I wait.
Thank you for joining us for HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Please join us again next week when we explore the best strategies for living with someone with Alzheimer's, plus the latest in transplants of the pancreas, and how nurses are expanding their roles in modern healthcare. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on iTunes. Just search for HealthLink on Air. That's all one word. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks so much for listening.